Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
This is the Sports Rivals, and with the basketball season once again upon us, a chance to look into our archives and talk about rivalries and college basketball in particular. We are brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. Do you believe? A reminder, don't forget our sponsor, BetOnline.ag. Head to BetOnline.ag today and take advantage of all of the great sign-up bonuses. Again, that's BetOnline.ag and sign up today. And today, it's about basketball.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Sports Rivals. I'm Gary Thorne. A delight to have you with us. Our purpose here is to preserve memories of classic sports rivalries through the words of those who participated in them. These are the rivalries that are described from the inside out. We should mention, I think today, we have Gary Williams, College Basketball Hall of Fame coach, Seth Greenberg, 34 years in the business of college coaching and a number of those years where he went up against Gary Williams. Should mention that we are doing this during the virus season, and we really appreciate these two great coaches coming on to join us. Just for purposes of the record, it is March 30th. 2020, obviously not an easy time for anybody, not for them, but they've taken time to do this, and we hope this can add a little bit of a smile and some good times when things obviously are not where we would all want them to be. Gary Williams is a Hall of Fame college coach. He won the NCAA championship coaching in Maryland in 2002. He was there at his alma mater, Maryland, for 22 years between 1989 2011. In an ACC conference that has always been and certainly was then a very tough conference. Seth Greenberg coached against him when Seth was at Virginia Tech. That was 2003 through 2012. As I said, Seth involved in college coaching for some 34 years. So when you look at that, they were rivals in the ACC in the years 2003 to 2011. And gentlemen, as best we can tell, we went back and tried to figure out how you did against each other. Believe it or not, not an easy thing to do because you got to go through all of the guides, press guides. It looks like you played 500 against each other, went 5-5. But the notable thing was the games between Maryland and Virginia Tech during those years filled with very tight ball games. There were overtime games. There was a double overtime game that we're going to be talking about. So let's get to it and let people hear from Gary Williams, Seth Greenberg. Seth, I'm going to start with you by asking, when you're coaching against an opposing team, obviously you're looking at what the opposing team is, who, what the makeup of the players are, but you're also looking at the coach who's sitting on that other bench. When you were at Virginia Tech coaching against Maryland and Gary Williams, what were your thoughts going into games about the coach you were facing?
I thought I was in trouble. I mean, you're talking about a Hall of Fame coach. You're talking about a guy that won a national championship. I came at a good time because I was after the Final Four and national championship team. So I got kind of a bump there as we came into the ACC. But look, when you were playing against Gary's team, and when I got into the league, one of the things I tried to do with Virginia Tech is our goal was to be the hardest playing, toughest team. We weren't going to get the guys Duke got, North Carolina got, and other teams got, but what I thought we could control was how hard we played. And I looked at actually the blueprint that Gary used at Maryland to build their program. Evaluate up, get your guys to play hard, get your guys to compete defensively, try to steal some possessions. But before we get into that, I have to admit, Gary, that like when we came into the ACC, no one wanted us in the league. And we were Virginia Tech. We were the worst team in the Big East. We fit the geographic footprint. In terms of the rest of the league, we weren't like Boston College or Syracuse or Louisville. I mean, we fit right there. Yet when we came into the league, you, Mike, Roy, whomever, they said, oh, Virginia Tech, they're absolutely going to kill the league because they suck at basketball. It's a football decision. And, you know, what's going to happen is it's going to do value in the league. And then we came in and we won some freaking games. And yeah, then, you know what? Everyone said we killed the league.
I know. You didn't help us by winning some games. That was for sure. You won a lot of games. And the thing was, you won a Duke, which, you know, I think coaches coached in the ACC and never won a Duke in their whole career. So I know when I got the job in 89 in Maryland, you know, we were going through some tough times there at Maryland. And it was the thing where you really got tired of people on your campus. And you, I don't know if you got this, Seth, too. People said, you know, you ought to try to have a program like Duke in North Carolina. So every time we played those guys, I remember it was usually some faculty guy. You know, he had the leather patches on his blazer and all that stuff, you know. And he'd be smoking his pipe at some faculty thing you had to go to. And that's all you heard. So that was my goal, you know, just get to where we could be competitive against Carolina and Maryland. And, you know, then we finally got to the Final Four in 2001. And now we're really good going into 2002. That's the year we won the championship. And I remember getting the preseason rankings, and we were still below Carolina and Duke. You know, it was like, that's the way it is in the ACC. You had to fight everything in terms of how the media perceived you, how referees perceived your program, your fans. You know, a lot of fans, you know, figured, well, you can never be as good as Duke or North Carolina. So all that went into coaching. And I think, Seth, you saw that when you came into the ACC, just how people felt, you know, about those two programs. And certainly Duke and Carolina have been two of the top five programs, say, for the last, you know, 40 years in college basketball.
Yeah, the funny thing is that, you know, we used all that motivation. You know, like, I cut out every single article that had either you or Mike or Roy or, you know, anyone else in the league basically killing us. And all I would legitimately go, you know, we'd be getting ready to play you guys or we'd play Duke. Or I'd go, and these son of a bitches didn't want us in the league. Screw them. We're going to kick them.
You got whatever it takes, you know, there's nothing, you know, it's like, you know, it was just the ACC. And, you know, I go back to the 60s with the ACC. I played at Maryland. I wasn't any good, but you didn't have to be good back that, you know, you didn't have to be that good back then to play. And it was the same way. Duke had, you know, Vic Bubas was way ahead of his time in terms of the business side of college basketball. And one year we go down there to play on Maryland. Bud Milliken was our coach, and Frank Fellows was a good guy. He was an assistant coach, but he had to teach three PE courses, and he was the only assistant. We go down there, and we're waiting to get on the court to practice the day before. Out comes the Duke staff, and it's Vic Bubas, and his two assistants were Chuck Daly and Hubie Brown. And I'm going like, what's this? You know, I mean, is this fair? You know, is this equal? How does that work? But back then, Maryland really thought of itself as a football school, and they just wouldn't pump any money into basketball until really Lefty got there in 1970.
How about my first trip to Duke as a head coach, I was an assistant in Virginia that one year in 1984. My first trip to Duke as a head coach, I lasted 38 minutes and 41 seconds to be exact. And then somehow, some way, Duke Etzel and I did not decide on the same restaurant to eat after the game. And I got whacked. We lost by about 400 points. You ever get thrown out at Cameron?
Yeah, I got thrown out once. And we didn't win though. We won after I got thrown out. You know, the next couple of years we were able to get a win down there. But I got thrown out the first 5 minutes of the game. And, you know, their locker room. You know, the one thing about Duke, yeah, they make a lot of money in their basketball program. Their visitors' locker room, it's got to be the worst still in the ACC, I would think, you know. But anyway, so I go down there, and I'm like, what do you do now? You got an hour and a half, you know, you're thrown out of the game. They had this old AM radio down there, so I got the Duke broadcast of the game, and that's how I followed the game that night. It was Hoosiers. You know, it was just like the guy at Hoosiers listening to the game after he got thrown out.
Hey, when Gary says the locker room's bad, it's like an old, they turn it into a faculty staff locker room where there's like rows of lockers. So there's nowhere where you can actually look at your team.
I know.
Because the benches are behind the rows of lockers. I mean, you're like in the middle standing by the shower, but your rest of your staff is in the shower. So there's no room for them to stand anywhere near. And it's like this one mini board that you can make notes on. My greatest story in that, we're getting to play them actually in the year we beat them. And my brother Brad is giving a scouting report. I'm in the other end of the locker room because I couldn't stand by him. So I'd have to walk through the middle to actually speak to the team at the end. And everyone's like leaning out from behind these little corners. And he was going over Greg Paulus. And he's saying, you know, when Greg Paulus does this, Greg Paulus does that. And I still remember to this day, Jamon Gordon, who was a really, really good guard for us, just tough as nails, defense player of the year in the league his senior year. It was really, really good. And he kind of raises his hand. And Jamon was a guy that was obviously never was afraid of anything. And he grew up in one of the toughest blocks in all of Jacksonville, Florida. He goes, Coach Green Bear. What's up, Jamon? He goes, Greg Paulus ain't worth a damn. If he had a JMU on his jersey, we wouldn't even be talking about his sorry ass.
it is funny how when a guy put a Duke or Carolina jersey on the ACC, all of a sudden he got a lot better. You know, it's interesting how that worked. I mean, and you saw it at the end of the year. You know, they'd have their all-conference teams and things like that. And, you know, it was a fight. It was a fight to get your guys, any recognition. And before the expansion, any expansion, we were the northernmost team. We were like way out of there. It was Clemson and South Carolina, the four Carolina schools, Virginia and us. And we were, the northernmost team. And then Georgia Tech came in and, Bobby really did a great job at Atlanta, getting people excited down there about the ACC.
How about we had some, we only competed. Look, you were a Hall of Fame coach. I just tried to stay employed, but we had some classic matchups. When I was asked to do this, I started to think about how about when the water main broke on campus.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to be a national TV game. And we're sitting there. You had one of the greatest lines of all time. We just built our practice facility. So we had this great, beautiful practice facility. No bleachers, no nothing. We had 10,000 people. 10,000 people in the place. The place was going bonkers. Right. It was some type of celebration. So the officials called us together. So we got this water main break. I remember Wim Sanderson was calling the game. He was scared to death because there were no bathrooms, and he had to go to the bathroom in 5 minutes, but that's another story. He went outside on the side of the building, he told me. But, yeah. So we meet with the officials, and you had this great idea. Now, I think what we should do is you got this great practice facility. You don't need people to be watching this game. We could just move over to the practice facility, and we could just play the game over there. How about my reaction? I said, you know me before.
There goes your home court. I told our players, I remember that. Really, I think it was supposed to be a 12 o'clock game. We wound up playing like around 5 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And so we're just sitting there, and like I told our players what happened about the truck hitting the water main, which really happened, right? That's the way it happened.
I told them
it was a beer truck. Well, I was telling the truth then to our players. I told them it was a beer truck, and they did that because they were already planning to celebrate after the game. whatever. And like you said, Seth, whatever it takes, you just tell your team, and hey, they don't know. They don't know. So you just tell them anything.
And that was a head game. The other one that I remember that was a good one was the double overtime game where Bravis scored about 1,000 against us.
Oh, that was the game. That was it.
That was the
beer truck game, yeah.
We had to do everything possible.
That guy, Vasquez, that year, we won our last 7 games to tie Duke, who won the national championship. That was 2010. And we tied Duke for the regular season ACC thing. And Vasquez hit a running half hook going toward the corner right in front of our bench. It was like Kareem Abdul skyhook range. It was like 18 feet. I looked down at Krzyzewski, and if he was standing close to me, I know he would have hit me, because like I kind of smiled, like makes that all the time. Don't worry about it, Mike. That's the way it goes. And like It was incredible. Then I remember the game. You beat us at our place. I don't know what year that
was. Throw-up game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're doing great. Was it your guy or my guy that threw up?
Oh, my guy.
Yeah, you had me. You made him throw up. That's why.
You said that every day.
Well, we were playing good, and then when after the throw-up, we couldn't play anymore, you know? It's like... But, like, how about the referees? They wouldn't go near it. Did you see? They were, like, 50 feet away. It was like some kind of radioactive thing, you know, in their minds.
Like, we had a Lorenzo Hudson.
I couldn't find a janitor, you know, to clean it.
Hey, we played it. We, that game was like this. You guys scored, like, the first 10 points of the game.
Yeah.
And we finally, Lorenzo Hudson drives and gets fouled. And he steps to the free throw line, one dribble, two dribble, sets the ball to shoot it, shoots it, and as he released it, he lost the pregame meal. All over the place. It was just short of the rim, his pregame meal. I mean, it was disgusting. And it took forever to clean up. And all of a sudden, we come out of that. Lorenzo makes the second free throw. He stays in the game because he felt better than he said. And we scored like the next, like 16 of the next 20 points. I do remember though, only as you can, I do remember as we were walking off the court, he turned to me with pointing at me, going, "You made him do that."
I know. that was part of the game plan. You kidding me? Hey, if we get behind, hey Lorenzo, if we get behind, you're gonna throw up. You know.
That was one of the wildest. I thought, and then the other one at your place where you beat us by about 400 was your next to last year because you actually went to the tournament this year with Neil and those guys.
Yeah, that was a pretty good team that didn't look good.
That,
you know, we were
that
ugly.
Team was good.
Yeah, we could play. Good. We could play.
Really,
and Vasquez was. Yeah, you know, Vasquez was really good. I mean, he was ACC Player of the Year in 2010, and he was a lot better than people thought. I really felt bad for him. We go to the NCAA tournament and we win the first game. Now we're playing Izzo in Michigan State. They got Green, and you know they're always good, but they were pretty good. So we're out in Spokane, and we get down 15 in the second half. We come back. Vasquez scores 10 points in the last minute and 10 seconds. They go down and hit a shot, you know, top of the circle and, you know, beat us. And I really felt bad for Vasquez because that was his last game. And while we were playing that day, we would play the winner of Kansas and Northern Iowa. And Northern Iowa beat Kansas in a complete upset. So, you know, we thought we could beat Northern Iowa if we could buy Michigan State. And then we would have had to beat Tennessee to go to the Final Four. So that's how that tournament goes, though. You know, you never, you know, you look at brackets and you think, well, that team's really good. They're going to be a problem if we have to play them. But, you know, you got to take care of business in the game you're in.
That team was really good. But they had the – we love Gary Buttons. I think your boy Scott, he had it made up because – he was pissed off that people didn't appreciate you or something. I walk out there, everyone's wearing those damn buttons. I'm going, we're screwed. We're going to lose by 100.
That was John Harbaugh was there. Bishop. We had the Ravens contingent for that game. we did that special for you. So,
and the Gravis Vasquez was the greatest because I'm recruiting Gravis Vasquez for 400 years. And at that time, you and Stu Vetter were kind of at odds for a little bit. And so I'm going, damn, we might end up with greatness. This is unbelievable. Maryland hasn't gotten involved yet. Da, 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 da. And then all of a sudden, I still remember going to Montrose Christian, like,
oh, yeah,
in November. And all of a sudden, I look down, and there you are with Stu. And I'm going, damn it. 2 days I'm here to work, and I'm done.
Stu and I became big buddies that year. Hey, you know, it was amazing. The year before, you know, we went over to recruit Durant. That's where Durant was going to school, in high school. I think that was his third high school. You know, he kind of drifted around a little bit. And, you know, obviously, you know, an incredible player. And that's why, so I didn't even know who Vasquez was. And I saw him, you know, a guy just, the one thing about Vasquez, he loved to play. Coaching guys like that, that was always when I did my best coaching job because I got a little tired as time went on of trying to get guys to play hard in practice. you know, come on, we're playing basketball. I mean, how tough is this? You know, this is supposed to be fun. It's a fun part of your day. And, you know, Vasquez, you never had to worry about that. He'd come in, he was like bouncing off the walls. He felt so fortunate to get out of Venezuela, come to the United States, get a chance to play basketball, play in the ACC, you know, the whole thing. And he always, you know, showed that when he played. And I love guys like that. And, you know, Vasquez was really criticized his first couple of years because he'd do a little shimmy if he made a three, you know, stuff like that. And, like, thank God I had coached Walt Williams a long time ago because Walt was a little crazy. In fact, he's the only guy that ever wore a headband that played for me because I didn't like headbands. You know, I thought they you know, what are you doing that for? You know, like, what's you trying to draw attention to yourself or whatever? But we got sanctions from the previous coach when I got there in 89. So Walt could have transferred and played right away back then. And he was really good. Walt was, you know, a lottery pick, the whole thing. And so he came to my office and he told me that spring that he wanted to wear a headband the next year. And I was ready to jump all over him. So I figured, well, if he's gone, we can't beat anybody. So, well, I think that's fine, you know. And what type of shoes would you like to wear this coming season? You know, whatever it took. Sometimes you got to recruit your own players. You know, that's just the way it goes.
And the way the rules are, now, you really got to recruit your own players because they're going to be able to, they're going to have to transfer immediately and then just and yeah. be eligible if that guideline passes.
I've seen some coaches this year. They do that handshake thing at the end of games, which I think that's got to go. You know, you know, it's okay if the two coaches shake hands. Players should get to their locker rooms after a game, but. That's another thing. But, you know, I saw coaches this year. They were handing out their business cards to the other guys in line, you know, which were going through there. I mean, that is – I mean, guys now, and I think I'm telling the truth here, they have their boards where they have their recruits, you know, this guy's a sophomore in high school, this guy's a junior in different classes. Now they got the transfer portal group up there on the board.
I've been in offices. It's funny. I was on one office. I'm not going to call the guy out, but – and he closed the door, we're sitting talking ball and everything. He was a good coach and, you know, people really liked. And on the back of his door, this is just grad transfers. Imagine what it's going to be next. He's got a list of 20 grad transfers. I turned to the guy and said, hey, just a little heads up. I was kind of new to college basketball, being an NBA guy. I said, let me just give you a little tidbit of information here. You might want to cover that because it's really probably not a good look. But, you know, talking about coaching, the one thing I knew about you and when we were trying to prepare for you guys is, like, we were in a timeout. I spent half of my timeouts trying to figure out what wrinkle you were going to do. Now, like, I knew it was a free throw situation. We were probably going to see the 55 or the 2-1-2 press, right. But you kind of tweaked that a couple of different ways. You might go to the point drop or the next possession. I knew we were going to see something tricky. What was the hardest? Like for me, I spent my timeouts just trying to plan for, especially late game, you know, last 5 minutes, what that next guy was going to do. You know, your sideline antics and mine as well were a tad bit famous. What was the craziest, what was going through your mind in the timeout?
What was that? I missed that last part.
I said, what was going through your mind in the timeout?
The big thing was, I worried about more how we were going to execute coming out of the timeout, whether we're on defense or offense. And, you know, what I liked about a timeout, if you were on defense, it allowed you to do something that you might not have done the rest of the game. Like, we might not have played any zone. We went zone that time after a timeout. We would do, we had a sideline press, which we, you know, keeping stats. I wasn't a big stat guy, but we kept a lot of stats on our pressure defense. The sideline press was the most effective. Now, we didn't do it as much as we did full court pressure. But, if you ever watch a game, you see the referee give the guy to a ball, give the guy to a ball on the sideline. And if we're in our aggressive press with a guy on a ball on the sideline, but we're going to trap, the first thing the guy does is look down at his feet to make sure he's out of bounds. Because most courts, you know, that you play in the ACC, they got benches, they got tables, the players' benches. And so players are never comfortable with a guy in their face on the sideline. They can handle the underneath thing most of the time, but not on the sideline. So we won some games just by being able to get the ball back on the sideline out of bounds play when we were on defense. And, you know, I always thought that was a great press, but, you know, and I was willing to share that with other people, but not a lot of guys do that. You know, they don't press against the sideline, which I always thought was the best press. And the thing was, teams always had pressure sets ready for our full court pressure, but they never really did anything but a straight line from the inbound guy when we were pressing on the sidelines. So we would practice that every day, practice for like 2-3 minutes, and got pretty good at it.
You guys got real good at it, unfortunately, because the water main break game, which we spent a ton of time preparing for the sideline press. Yeah. All right, we spread ourselves out. We ran a guy all the way up the floor to stretch the back line guy. And if I'm not mistaken, we threw one skip pass. We were not supposed to throw the deepest pass, but we threw one short skip pass, which you guys stole at the end of that game. And that's one of those things. Like in league play especially, people got to understand, I think you'd agree with this, there's a more level playing field. You got to find a way to steal a basket, whether it's a free throw situation, out of the timeout, first play to half, first play of the game. And every possession in league play is so important offensively and defensively that, you know, we would always try, like, if you ran all that flex rollback action, we spent so much time preseason that we called that just Maryland. So when we drilled Maryland, we would legitimately, that was one of our shell actions that we would, from the first day of practice to when we played you, we would drill right. that every day just to take the duck in a way. But then you added a couple of wrinkles on us 1 year. And I'm not mistaken, the wrinkle was like a back screen out of it. The rollback guy would set a back screen. And
yeah.
Lob and,
we could get and, a lob out of it.
That really pissed me off.
Yeah. We were always basic on offense. In other words, we ran all our man stuff was out of that same inverted set where we have our point guard, our 5 and 4 would be like a 45 degree angle, about 18 feet up from the block. And then 2 and 3 were on the block. And, you know, that was, we tried to run everything from the same look. And I wanted people to think that all we ran was the flex, which, you know, when you got in league play, like you said, teams would figure out that wasn't all we ran. But we tried to run everything basically looking like we were going to run the flex. And I think that helped us when we had like a really good player like a Vasquez or a Juan Dixon, where we could get him some individual stuff, which really wasn't out of the flex. But I think unless you scouted us really well, like league teams do, you would think it came from the flex situation.
Guys, let me jump in because it's just great. I really want to get from each of you, though, as the time goes by and you look back on all these games and talking about playing against one another and how tough the ACC was. Each of you talk about the memory you have right now of looking at each other on the other's bench and what you remember most. Gary, I'll start with you. What you remember most about Seth, and then Seth, talk about what the memories are about Gary that are with you right now.
Sure.
Well, I respected Seth because I knew he earned his way there. In other words, he wasn't one of those golden boys. You see guys now, as they get jobs when they're 24, they're making $250,000 a year. Well, I think Seth and I I was a JV coach in Camden, New Jersey. That was my first job. Yeah. And so I always respected the coaches. And, you know, you look at a guy like Krzyzewski. He was, you know, he was an assistant at Army. Then he was the head coach at Army, you know, and really had to build the program at Duke. So you respected that. And then, you know, you look at a Roy Williams. I think he was a manager in North Carolina. I don't think he even played. And, you know, just to work as hard as, you know, those people do, like Seth, you're impressed with that. And then when you go play those guys, you know that they're going to play hard because that's what they did. They worked hard to get to where they were. So I always knew if we played Virginia Tech, we'd be in for a war. You know, there's some teams that were really talented that you would rather play than a team that was, you know, going to work yeah. really hard against you. You know, you didn't want that in your face the whole time. So I always respected Seth for that. Plus, you know, guys, you have to coach more at some places. Virginia Tech was not going to be an easy job when Seth took the job. And, you're playing against in the best conference in the country then. I don't think there was much of an argument that the ACC was the best conference in the country. So it's not like you're looking at, you know, your conference schedule and all of a sudden, well, that team, we should be able to beat twice and, you know, that type of thing. You thought every game was going to be a fight, and you were right, you know, and that's what Seth had to deal with. He had to get that program up to a point where they could compete against, you know, the best teams in the country, and he did. And so as a coach, when you look down the other bench, I never told Seth this, we were coaching against each other, but you really respected that. And I think that was, you know, how I looked at Seth.
Yeah. Well, that means a lot to me. You know, it's interesting. When I took over at Virginia Tech, our goal was the blueprint that we used was the Maryland blueprint. And, you know, when Garrett took over at Maryland, you got to understand they were coming off probation or on probation. They were not the Maryland of Lefty Driesell, and they surely were not the Maryland that we know of Gary Williams and national championships and Juan Dixon. But when I looked at it, I said, like, how did they build their program? And, you know, they built it by high character, tough guys, guys that played hard, guys that understood were winning players, guys that bought into the good of the group. And their mindset, especially when Gary took over, because they were in a transition period, and the league was the best. When the league was ridiculous back then.
That was Grant Hill. You had Grant Hill and those guys. They won two straight years. Carolina came in right behind him, and they won 2 out of 3 years, I think. So it was a joke.
It was ridiculous then, is that, you know, the mindset of not being an opponent. I took that from, you know, obviously what people didn't want to say, but I looked at Gary, the way he coached his team, the one thing you knew is that they weren't going to be an opponent. If they were in there, I don't care if they were in the rebuilding stage or whatever, they were in there to compete and win. They weren't going to back down to anyone, any player, any coach. And like my mindset was, and I watched Gary coach. My assistant, I was bad. I wasn't as tough on my assistants as he was now during the course of the game.
Yeah, I look back at that.
Oh my God! But he was better to his guys away from the court than I was probably. But here's the deal: I knew Gary's teams as I watched them. They were going to draw a line in the sand every single play. And if we took a playoff, that was going to be the play that cost us our game. And legitimately, I would sit in meetings and, you know, like I knew Gary forever. Gary coached at American University. My brother played there, obviously, way before that. And we went back a long way. And, you know, Joe Harrington, who was a teammate of his, hired me at Long Beach State. So there was a connection for a lot of years there. But they were literally – I would sit in our meetings and say, all right, Maryland's doing this. You know, how can we fit that to what we were doing? And then the other thing is, look, if you talk about the greatest coaches, you don't become a Hall of Fame coach. You don't win a national championship. But more importantly, American University, Boston College, Ohio State, and Maryland, you don't win everywhere you've been unless you are really smart and really good and can evaluate and get your guys to buy in, trust you, play hard, and play for each other. So we legitimately wanted to be the Maryland. You know, Lefty wanted to be the UCLA of the East. We wanted to be the Maryland of Virginia. And that was because of what Gary did. And that's 100% from the...
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
Guys, absolutely wonderful. I'm sitting here listening as a fan, and I just marvel at the stuff you guys give out, and I really deeply appreciate it. Our guests here this time around, Seth Greenberg and Gary Williams, ACC, and their memories of coaching against one another in those great years in a conference that, as Gary said, there were none really as good in those years as was the ACC. And that is going to conclude another chapter of These Sports Rivals. To learn more about this and other episodes, we invite you to log on to thesportsrivals.com. You can join the conversation with questions and any suggestions you have for future shows. You can also follow us on Instagram at thesportsrivals, Twitter at rivals_podcast, and on Facebook by searching for The Sports Rivals Podcast. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you to Seth and Gary for just a wonderful half hour of a look back at some great college basketball. And always remember, it is the rivalries that make the games.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.